Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. I'll be shining the spotlight on some of the writings of Cardinal John Henry Newman. And joining our popular Latin lover. But first, when an archbishop and a sultan make a joint appeal. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. In a few moments, I'll be taking you with me to Nigeria, where on the 20th of January, an archbishop and a sultan made a joint appeal to stop the killing in the city of Jos, where recent violence left hundreds dead and thousands on the run. The two men are the co-chairmen of the Nigerian Inter-Religious Council, which brings together 25 Christian leaders and as many Muslims in this African nation. For Islam, they are the Sultan of Sokoto, Mohammed Saad Abubakar, and for Christianity, the Catholic Archbishop of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, John Onoyekan. The tragic events in Jos, they write in this appeal, quote, challenge us all to address the deep hurts and festering wounds, the unresolved grievances, specifically challenging the leadership of both faiths to join hands in deploying the best of our spiritual resources in this difficult task of healing the painful memories of the past, thus paving the way for a brighter future, unquote. Also in this statement, they insist that God has been good to their nation, their problems self-inflicted and well within their control. I met with the Catholic Archbishop who made this joint appeal together with the Sultan here in Rome 2 days after this statement was issued. As I discovered, he's a man of great presence, but one of great simplicity too, introducing himself to me simply as John. Archbishop John, then, is a brave man, as you may imagine, issuing statements together with the leader of the Islamic community.
I must say that the position that the Sultan and I are taking publicly is not very easy. Nor do we even have the full support and admiration of our respective membership. Because there are Christians who are not happy with me, according to them, hobnobbing with the Sultan. They even tell me, oh, these Muslims, you can never trust them. They are always playing games. But they forget that the Sultan is getting exactly the same kind of thing from some of his Muslims who warn him against that archbishop. Should not be hobnobbing with Christians. But I think this is the whole sense of being a leader, to be able to go above this kind of feelings of ordinary people and lead them in a direction that is best for everybody. I personally believe very firmly that the job I have, and if God, since God has put me in this position, it is my duty not to lead Christians in a battle against Muslims, but to lead Christians to stretch out hands and meet fellow human beings, fellow believers in God, for a better country that will live in peace and prosperity. This is probably one of the grace of God that has come over us in the last few years, that we have succeeded gradually to forge formal relationship with the leadership of the Islamic community.
The north of Nigeria is a remotely familiar place to me as I lived there for a while many years ago. Witnessing the reverence the people had there for the present Sultan's father, the late Abubakar Sadiq II, whose stature to the people's eyes seemed almost mythical, I remember once how, when crossing the Sultan's car on my way somewhere, I witnessed with disbelief how my driver stalled the car instantly and prostrated himself full length on the dusty soil. And so did everyone else, by the way. The current Sultan is his son, his heir to a 2-century-old throne founded by his great-grandfather, 19th-century Islamic reformer Sheikh Usman Danfodio. But I think I'll give the word to Archbishop John to tell you more about him, this soldier-turned-sultan whom he knows well.
He is a very enlightened gentleman, a former colonel in the Nigerian army. He retired with a major general rank. He's had experience of not only commanding Nigerian forces that are made up of both Christians and Muslims. His last military assignment was military attaché in Pakistan, Iran, and Iraq. So he is well aware of what it means to promote Islamic fundamentalism and the challenges it poses, even for a Muslim state. He's trying his best to make sure that we do not repeat in Nigeria, by we, I mean the Muslim community, does not repeat in Nigeria the mistakes that he's seen elsewhere. And apart from that, broad-mindedly, me and him, we are in very good terms. We're talking very well together, and in fact, we issued a common statement on the just issue. Well, he can talk as the head of the Muslims and say whatever he likes about what is happening, and I too can talk as leader of the Christians, saying whatever I say about it. It will not really make as much impact as if both of us, with one voice, can say something together. In which case, we are addressing everybody. And the statement clearly dissociates religion from violence and killing. And my own reading of it is that if we can both say so, then if there are any Christians out there who decide to go killing, they cannot say they are doing it in the name of religion. They would then be forced to tell the whole world why they are fighting. That way too, hopefully, we can become part of the solution rather than becoming a rallying point for conflicting people.
And warm thanks there to the Archbishop of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, John Onoyekan, for taking the time to share with us this information. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast on a completely different note, this week, as we know, Benedict XVI met with the bishops of England and Wales, led by the president of their bishops' conference, the Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nichols. The bishops were in Rome on their ad limina visit and were received in audience by the Pope on Monday, 1st of February. On this occasion, the Pope spoke to them of his forthcoming apostolic visit to Great Britain, touching on many sensitive issues, but also highlighting in a special way the figure of an eminent Englishman who's soon to be beatified. He's Cardinal John Henry Newman. A man, the Holy Father remarked, who left us an outstanding example of faithfulness to revealed truth. Let's listen to what he said.
He left us an outstanding example of faithfulness to revealed truth by following the kindly light wherever it led him, even at considerable personal cost.
Benedict XVI then noted how Newman saw himself first and foremost as a priest, calling on the bishops present to hold him up to priests during this year dedicated in a special way to priesthood as an example of dedication to prayer, pastoral sensitivity towards the needs of his flock, and passion for preaching the gospel.
In Newman's words, Christ's priests have no priesthood but his. What they do, he does. When they baptize, he is baptizing. When they bless, he is blessing.
Well, Well, attentive to Pope Benedict's words and in a tribute to Newman's scholarship and his writings, you ought to stay tuned and join Jill Bevilacqua, who's taken the time to select some readings from this author for us.
John Newman spent the first half of his life as an Anglican, and then became the most celebrated convert of his time. He was born in London in 1801. At the age of 15, he had what he later called an interior conversion, when he became convinced of the truth of the Christian revelation.
The Christian has a deep, silent, hidden peace which the world sees not. What he is, when left to himself and to his God, that is his true life. He can bear himself, he can, as it were, joy in himself, for it is the grace of God within him. It is the presence of the eternal Comforter in which he joys. He can bear, he finds it pleasant, to be with himself at all times, never less alone than when alone. He can lay his head on his pillow at night, and own in God's sight with overflowing heart that he wants nothing, that he is full and abounds, that God has been all things to him, and that nothing is not his which God could give him. More thankfulness, more holiness, more of heaven he needs indeed, but the thought that he can have more is not a thought of trouble, but of joy.
Newman took Anglican orders and became a tutor at Oriel College, Oxford, and a famous university preacher. He was one of the founders of the Oxford movement. From the year 1838, Newman began to have doubts about the Anglican position. The following year, he had just completed a comprehensive reading of the Church Fathers.
Hardly had I brought my course of reading to a close when the Dublin Review of that same August was put into my hands by friends who were more favourable to the cause of Rome than I was myself. There was an article in it on the Anglican claim by Bishop Wiseman. It was on the Donatists, with an application to Anglicanism. I read it and did not see much in it. The Donatist controversy was known to me for some years. The case was not parallel to that of the Anglican Church. St. Augustine was in Africa and wrote against the Donatists in Africa. They were a furious party who made a schism within the African Church and not beyond its limits. But my friend, an anxiously religious man, a Protestant still, pointed out the words of St. Augustine, which were contained in one of the extracts made in the review and which had escaped my observation. Securus judicat orbis terrarum. He repeated these words again and again, and when he was gone, they kept ringing in my ears. The words of St. Augustine struck me with a power which I never had felt from any words before. They were like the turn again Whittington of the chime. They were like the tolle legge, take up and read, of the child which converted St. Augustine himself. By those great words of the ancient father, the theory of the via media was absolutely pulverized. I had seen the shadow of a hand upon the wall.
Newman's conversion was not immediate. He had no blinding flash of vision. As he wrote himself,
all the logic in the world would not have made me move faster towards Rome than I did. As well might you say that I have arrived at the end of my journey because I see the village church before me, as venture to assert that the miles over which my soul had to pass before it got to Rome could be annihilated, even though I had had some far clearer vision than I then had, that Rome was my ultimate destination. Great acts take time.
It took Newman another 6 years, towards the end of which he wrote his essay in the development of Christian doctrine, from which the celebrated phrase comes, "To live is to change, and to be perfect is to have changed often." In fact, Newman declared that he had begun this essay as an Anglican, but ended it as a Catholic. His doubts kept him company all the way.
My difficulty was this. I had been deceived greatly once. How could I be sure that I was not deceived a second time? I then thought myself right. How was I to be certain that I was right now? How many years had I thought myself sure of what I now rejected? How could I ever have confidence again in myself? To be certain is to know that one knows. What test had I that I should not change again after that I had once become a Catholic? I had still apprehension of this, though I thought a time would come when it would depart. However, some limit ought to be put to these vague misgivings. I must do my best and then leave it to a higher power to prosper it. So I determined to write an essay on doctrinal development, and then, if at the end of it my convictions in favor of the Roman Church were not weaker, to make up my mind to seek admission into her fold. I acted upon this resolution in the beginning of 1845 and worked at my essay steadily into the autumn. As I advanced, my view so cleared that instead of speaking any more of the Roman Catholics, I boldly called them Catholics. Before I got to the end, I resolved to be received, and the book remains in the state in which it was then, unfinished.
Just before he entered what he called the one fold of the Redeemer, Newman penned these words, in conclusion to his essay.
Time is short, eternity is long. Put not from you what you have here found. Regard it not as mere matter of present controversy. Set not out resolved to refute it, and looking about for the best way of doing it. Seduce not yourself with the imagination that it comes of disappointment, disgust, or restlessness, or wounded feeling, or undue sensibility, or other weakness. Wrap not yourself round in the associations of past years, nor determine that to be truth which you wish to be so, nor make an idol of cherished anticipations. Time is short, eternity is long.
When Newman was made a cardinal at the age of 78, he took the opportunity, in his speech of acceptance, to give voice to one of his favourite themes, the opposition of religious liberalism.
To one great mischief I have from the first opposed myself. For 30, 40, 50 years I have resisted to the best of my powers the spirit of liberalism in religion. Never did Holy Church need champions against it more sorely than now, when, alas, it is an error overspreading as a snare the whole earth. Liberalism in religion is the doctrine that there is no positive truth in religion, that one creed is as good as another, and this is the teaching which is gaining substance and force daily. It is inconsistent with any recognition of any religion as true. Men may go to Protestant churches or to Catholic. Men may get good from both and belong to neither. Religion is in no sense the bond of society. Instead of the church's authority, the philosophers and politicians would substitute, first of all, a universal and thoroughly secular education. As to religion, it is a private luxury, which a man may have if he will, but which, of course, he must pay for, and which he must not obtrude upon others or indulge in to their annoyance. Such is the state of things, and I lament it deeply, because I foresee that it may be the ruin of many souls.
John Newman was a man of many parts, but one of his most attractive qualities was his gift for friendship. Here, in conclusion, he gives us his ideas on Christian friendship.
We find our Saviour had a private friend, and this shows us, first, how entirely he was a man, as much as any of us, in his wants and feelings. And next, that there is nothing contrary to the spirit of the gospel, nothing inconsistent with the fullness of Christian love, in having our affections directed in an especial way towards certain objects, towards those whom the circumstances of our past life or some peculiarities of character have endeared to us. There have been men before now who have supposed Christian love was so diffusive as not to admit of concentration upon individuals, so that we ought to love all men equally. And many there are who, without bringing forward any theory, yet consider practically that the love of many is something superior to the love of one or two, and neglect the charities of private life while busy in the schemes of an expansive benevolence or of effecting a general union and conciliation among Christians. Now I shall here maintain, in opposition to such notions of Christian love, and with our Saviour's pattern before me, that the best preparation for loving the world at large and loving it duly and wisely is to cultivate an intimate friendship and affection towards those who are immediately about us.
And a big thank you there to Jill Bevilacqua, who took the time to select these readings from Cardinal John Henry Newman. Finally, why not join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. Just watch the change of pace and tone. Father, ready, steady, go. How do you say that in Latin?
What is that? Ready?
Steady, go.
Parati, firmi, ite. Parati, ready, firmi, okay. Steady, ite, go.
You may have guessed what I want to talk about. I want to talk about one of the Romans' favourite pastimes, chariot racing. How do you say that? My favourite pastime is chariot racing.
Equiria were horse races, and these were the curuum. It's certamen curuum. It's curus is a chariot. Quadrigarum or bigarum, two horses or four horses. Oh, they had a whole system there.
It was a rough game, wasn't it?
Yes.
I read somewhere that the first charioteer to do seven laps won. How do you say seven laps?
Oh, yeah. Well, septem curriculum. Qui primus septem curricula perfecit vicit. Or something like that, perfectionat vincebat.
You've always told me that the Romans were rough characters. They were kind of crude. And
they were.
I imagine that all possible fouls were admitted, no?
Oh, yeah.
How does one say that?
Fouls, yeah. Oh, fouls. Yeah,
all possible fouls were admitted.
Yeah. Admittebantur, tolerabantur. What are you going to say? No. Omnes violationes.
Was there someone like a referee?
Not really.
How does one say a referee?
Arbiter. That was pretty clear. Who survived, and that was about it.
The charioteers could whip each other or...
Or do anything.
How do you say that?
To say verberare poterant.
And squeezing the chariot against the spina until it shattered.
Oh, Lord, deliver us.
How do you say that? Squeezing the chariot against
Bene,
the spina?
Comprimere vel ilidere curum in spinam.
I guess this is something they didn't do, but I'd like you to translate this for me anyway. They never collided head on because they were all going the same direction. So how do you say colliding head on?
What are you going to say? You say capitibus collidebantur. Capitibus, with heads. Collidebantur, they would smash together with heads. We're impressed by Hollywood and Ben-Hur and all that stuff.
Well, it was a lot of fun.
Which is half right and half wrong or whatever.
There's an expression we use a lot in English, which is putting spokes in people's wheels. I think it comes from racing, no? They used to make the chariot skid, hitting the spokes of the wheel. How do you say making something skid?
A lobby to slip out. A lobby, that you can say.
Getting back to the English expression I mentioned earlier, putting a spoke into someone's wheel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, don't you?
Not exactly.
Well, I mean, you know,
I can understand.
Well, say somebody who didn't want us to do this program, they would come and cause trouble, no?
Well, spinam in yicere in rotam. spinam, a thorn in yicere, throw into the wheel. You have to think of some of these things for a while.
The charioteers rode chariots, but jockeys today ride bareback, no? Mm. How would you say jockey?
I'm trying to think of other ones.
Riding bareback.
That's all right.
Equus what?
Equus sine sella. Equus sine sella, without a saddle. Equus sine sella. That makes sense.
Who were the charioteers? Were they just poor people or wealthy people? Did the emperors ever take part in the races?
Oh, yeah, certainly they did.
Emperors like who? People like Nero?
Yeah, certainly they did. All famous people did, certainly. Were killed or became famous as...
Did they have, like, different stables?
Horses.
With their colours?
Oh, yeah, certainly. The four colours. Blue, green, red and white. The four colour, four teams.
So blue is Veneta?
No.
That's light blue.
Yeah. And what else?
And then red?
Not rosa.
Rusata.
Rusata, yes, exactly.
Green?
That's a nice one, too. EP green. I'm losing my head.
Prasinus.
Prasinus is pea green. And then, of course, you had, I don't know.
White.
Albus.
It was like a pomp and circumstance thing, wasn't it? Because they had a parade before the chariot races.
Well, of course, you have like your Indianapolis Speedway with your Ferrari, you know, with Schumacher and all this other
Formula
stuff.
Formula One. How would you say Formula One?
It's in Formula Prime of the first formula. So the same story. The Romans have the same stuff we have.
So you say not everybody survived the race?
No.
How would you say that?
Non omnes superaverunt, certamen.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Laudetur Jesus Christus.